drawn from the Psalm, Psalm 90. We have sung it, but I would encourage you to have an open Bible as we look at it. It is just as Deuteronomy from the pen of Moses, and it is the only psalm in our Psalter with his name. It is likely the only psalm that he penned that we use. It is in some ways an enigma. To get at the heart of what this psalm teaches, we really need to ask five very pertinent questions. And if we ask these questions, I think that what Moses is saying will become very, very clear to us. The first is, since this psalm is overwhelmingly about God, God is the focus of the psalm, what does Moses tell us about God? Who is God in Psalm 90? Well, working our way through the psalm, the first thing we find is that God is our dwelling place. Now, who is us and our? Well, we're going to discuss that more at length as we get into the psalm, but for right now, understand Moses is talking about all the sons of Adam, and he says that who God is your rightful home. That's where you should be at home at. If you are descended from Adam, you have a home, and that home is the Lord himself. He is where you find safety. He is where you find love and security. Other passages of Scripture say that if a man wanders from his home, he is like a bird who has lost his nest. He is without comfort. He is without basic necessities. He is in danger of the elements. He is in danger of predators. He is a lost soul just wandering and unattached. In Scripture, home is an incredibly important thing. To have a home, to be at home, to be received into home is to be where you are supposed to be. And Moses begins by defining God as he has been the rightful home for man in all generations. God is eternal, and in every generation of man, if man wants to find home, if he wants to be welcomed into that place which is his safety, his health, his security, his place of love, that's God. That's where man will find his home, because God is eternal. After telling us that he is our dwelling place, he goes on to take us to creation and to go beyond it. He says, Lord, before you ever created the earth or you ever brought the mountains forth, before that, eternally, from everlasting and to everlasting, you are God. You are infinite, eternal, unchangeable. In your being, your attributes, you are everything, everywhere, at all times. You are the eternal one, and no thing else is. No person, no place, no thing, but you, from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Moses defines God in such a glorified, high way that God is everything. He is everywhere. He is not everything, but he is in everything. God is so much that his creation is a speck compared to him. As Paul would put it, we live and we move and we have our being in the Lord. But ironically, that is probably why the Spirit is inspiring Moses to say it. We are surrounded by God's actions. We are surrounded by his creation. We are surrounded by his definitions. We are surrounded by his laws. We are surrounded by such an amazing cloud of evidences to his existence in every moment that we almost overlook him because he is literally active everywhere we look. Moses reminds us that before the eternal hills were ever made, before Everest ever rose before anything was anything, God was and God always will be. We heard that last Lord's Day too. The psalmist in Psalm 102 pleaded with God to remember his weakness because in verse 25 through 27, God was the eternal. Of old you laid the foundations of the earth, and the heavens are the work of your hands. They will perish, but you will endure. Yes, they will all grow old like a garment, like a cloak you will change them, and they will be changed, but you are the same, and your years will have no end. God is everywhere we look. He is eternal. He is in every time, in every place. And when time gives way, either in the past or the future, God still is. In verse 3 through 6, Moses defines God as man's destroyer. He looks at man, he looks at the sons of Adam, and he says to them, "Return to dust. Go back to dust, O sons of men." This destruction is both active and passive. If you look at the first verse there, verse 3, you turn men to destruction and say, "Return, O children of men, for," which means because, "a thousand years in your sight are like yesterday when they are past, and like a watch in the night." That's kind of a passive way of describing it. You will eternally exist, but you watch men pass into death. You who could, if you willed, keep them in existence forever, you don't do that. You continue to exist, and they pass, and they pass, and they pass, and it's a rolling stream. But Moses wants you to know it is not just passive. He uses active language in verse 5. You carry them away like a flood. They are like asleep. The image of being like asleep is when you wake up and you're trying to remember your dreams and it's all disjointed and you really don't know what it meant and it's all fading and within just a few moments it's all gone and you don't know what it was. Well, man is like that, says Moses, because the Lord is his destroyer. Like a rolling stream, he is rolling generation after generation after generation out of existence. And while passively he could stop the process, actively he is causing it. It is God's will that it take place. He is angry and he is wrathful in verse 7 and 8. "For we have been consumed by your anger," says Moses, "and by your wrath we are terrified. You have set our iniquities before you, our secret sins in the light of your countenance." There are, of course, those who would at this point become very angry and say, "You have presented God as angry and wrathful. Well, that's not my God." And you're probably right. It's not. It's not your God. If that's how you feel, that's not your God. It's just the God that really is that. Moses is not telling us everything about God, but he is telling us that he is angry and he is wrathful, and the God of the Old Testament is the Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. So any attempt to say, well, there's an Old Testament God and a New Testament God, falls apart when you look at how the new and old go together. Moses is describing God, and he defines him. He has anger, and he has wrath, and quite frankly, well, he should. Moses has already laid the foundation for why God would be wrathful. He is the owner of all things by virtue of creation. Before the mountains were brought forth, forever you had formed the earth and the world, even from everlasting to everlasting, you are God. Much like Psalm 24, which we often sing, the doctrine of creation is the foundation of God's ownership. In Psalm 24, we say, the earth is the Lord's in all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein. So he owns it. Why does he own it? Well, verse 2 begins with 4, which means because. For he has founded it upon the seas and established it upon the waters. God created it. He set all of its patterns into order. He owns it. He is king by virtue of creation. Therefore, as king, he has the right to be obeyed. He has the right to be glorified. He has the right to receive our service. And as you can clearly hear from this psalm, that's not what the sons of Adam do. And so God, as the rightful owner, God as the rightful king, sits in judgment on men, and this judgment is very clear and obvious. The judgment can be seen every time we die. God has cursed us with death, says Moses. He rolls us away generation after generation. This is not the perfect will of God, as some theologians would say. God did not create the world to have death in it. It is a testimony every time anyone dies that God is wrathful, that God is angry. God is the rightful ruler and man is rebellious. But in verse 12, we learn that God is also our possible teacher. Moses is praying to God and he asks for him to act. And we read, so teach us to number our days that we may gain a heart of wisdom. Sinners though we are, rebels though we are, there is hope for us in God's actions. And Moses is calling upon God to act. Teach us to realize how brief we are. Teach us wisdom. Man has a possible hope. He has a hope for redemption, and that is God himself. Verse 13 to 16 is a prayer of intercession. Return, O Lord, how long, and have compassion on your servants. O satisfy us early with your mercy, that we may rejoice and be glad all our days. Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil. Let your work appear to your servants and your glory to their children. So just as Moses has defined God as a wrathful king, he also defines God as the only hope we have from that wrath. He appeals to God that he act and that he deliver us from everything he's been talking about. And God will hear such a prayer. That is part of who he is as well. And finally, Moses defines God as the only hope we have for the establishment of our work. And let the beauty of the Lord our God be upon us, and establish the work of our hands for us. Yes, establish the work of our hands. As most of you know, I have for the past year been teaching world religions for a local college. It's been interesting. It's only mildly satisfying because, well, I know them like the back of my hand. I don't believe them. And so, you know, you can imagine how that works. But there is quite a bit of... There's quite a bit of knowledge to be known, and this verse reminds me of Taoism. Taoism is a very complicated religion, like all man's religions are, but the concept of the Tao, among other things, is the force of history, and the force of history erases everything man does. A Taoist begins his religion seeing this impersonal force erasing generation after generation in every mark of their works, so that no matter what kind of empire you raise, no matter what kind of great business you create, no matter how significant you may be in your age, the Tao is going to wash it all away, and there'll be no evidence of you eventually. So literally everything you do is meaningless, because it will be washed away. Now, interestingly, the Taoist says, since that's the way things are, stop doing things. That's literally the teaching of Taoism. You will be happy if you stop trying to be significant. Don't build anything. Don't be significant. Don't get degrees. Don't build companies. Don't become emperors. The Tao will sweep everything away. So just be happy with existence and nothing else. The Bible, however, has a total different approach. The Bible sees this grinding force moving through history as a testimony of God's wrath. Moses has already told us that God is the one washing us away. He is the rolling stream causing everything to disappear. But because he's the one doing it, and because he is our hope, it is possible to appeal to him that the work of our hands be established. So rather than being Taoists and deciding to just decide nothing means anything, the Bible believer turns to God and prays for mercy. Lord, it is you who can establish the work of a man's hands. It is you who can make my life significant. It is you who can help me build something significant. Lord, do that. And Moses, in saying this, defines God as the only one who can do that. That is who God is, according to Psalm 90. But Psalm 90 is a contrast. Moses defines God, and at the same time, he defines man. And so our next question is, according to Moses in Psalm 90, who is man? Well, we start at the beginning of the psalm again, and we find out that man only is at home when he is in God. Whatever else he may be, if he wants to have any sort of health or significance or safety, if he wants to have any sort of love and acceptance, he will find it in God and nowhere else. Moses is talking about all the sons of Adam. There is no other home for man than God. In verse 2 and 3, we read that Augustine is correct in the prayer that we used in our liturgy. Man is a due part of God's creation. God made everything in the world, according to verse 2. That includes you and me, because we are in the world. If you can see it, touch it, hear it, think about it, it's from God's hand, and I can see, touch, and think about you, and you can see, touch, and think about me. We are a due part of God's creation. When he began creating, the eternal, which is before creation and will be after creation, the eternal creates us. We are the work of someone else's hand. God is the reason there is a mankind. In verse 5 and 6, we find out that we are finite, and we are guaranteed to die. The days of our lives are 70 years, and if by reason of strength they are 80 years, yet their boast is only labor and sorrow, says verse 10, building on verse 5 and 6. Man feels like an immortal. Man thinks like an immortal. Man's actions oftentimes look like someone who believes he is going to be in the world forever, but man's definition is he's not. No matter who he is, no matter how significant he has ever been, no matter what God does with him, or no matter how evil he may be, the one thing you can guarantee about a man is there will come a day when he won't be here. You will look for him and he won't be here. No matter how much you loved him, or matter how much you hated him, no matter how significant or insignificant, the man will be gone. God is infinite, but man is finite, and that is because of God's anger and wrath. Why does man sometimes act like an immortal and think like an immortal? It's because man was created to continue. It is not technically true that man was ever immortal, because to be immortal means to have subsistence in yourself. And the only thing that has that is God himself. God is self-subsistent. But man was created to be perpetual. We were not created to die. We were created to live in his presence. And that's the way we would be if sin had never entered the world. We still often think like that. We do amazing things that make us look like we think that's going to happen. Several years ago, Elder Gene was telling me a story about a man who died, and when Gene was going through his property, he had a warehouse of really expensive cars. I don't remember what type, but they were multi-thousands of dollars worth of cars. This man had collected all these cars to himself, a whole warehouse of them. What was a mortal going to do with a warehouse of cars? Someday you will die, and you will not drive one of them. But if you were immortal, it would make perfect sense to gather together everything you like, world without end. We do things like that. But Moses defines us as finite. The space of your life is, on an average, 70 years. You may end up being 80. You may end up being more, because Moses is using generality. But lucky you, after 70, you begin to fall apart. The life after 70 is sorrow and pain, and eventually you soon fly away. Man is finite. He is lacking a true knowledge of his danger and his estate. When Jonathan Edwards addressed his church that fateful Lord's Day, probably most of the people who walked into the church assumed, I'm good with God because I'm a member of the church and I'm doing religious things. They assumed that they were good religious people. As man tends to do, he is totally oblivious to his real state. And so in verse 12, when Moses is defining man, when he is praying to God for man, he asks for man to have a heart of wisdom because man doesn't have it. Man's wisdom says, I am the center of the world. I will always be. How could the world live without me? Moses prays, oh Lord, let them realize their danger. Let them realize every funeral they go to, literally the bell chimes for them. This is a testimony to the danger you're in. Lord, give us a heart of wisdom because we don't have it. Just like we see your hand everywhere around us and we don't see it, we see the testimony of your wrath everywhere and we don't pay attention to it. Lord, give us a heart of wisdom that will stop. In verse 13 through 16, Moses defines man as in need of redemption. Return, O Lord, have compassion upon us. We truly need that. O Lord, establish us. O Lord, make us glad. O Lord, come and move among us. Because by definition, while you are perfect and eternal, we are under your wrath. Lord, help us. And then finally, defining man is unable to establish the work of his hands. Men live like they can. Men build empires. Men raise monuments. Men expect the work of their hands to be passed to son, to son, to son, and to live forever. But just a little look at the world says that's not likely. The reason why the Taoists think that everything gets washed away is because, well, that's fairly clear to watch. Man can't establish the work of his hands. He can't save himself. He can't get out of God's wrath. He can't even give himself a heart of wisdom. Moses defines mankind very clearly, and it is not a very pretty picture. Thus, farward, the comparisons. But having looked at man and God and the two of them in contrast, we probably need to ask the psalm, what men is Moses speaking about? There is a fairly old and established way of interpreting this psalm that says, because this is the only psalm we have for Moses, and because it talks about the wrath of God, the historical context of the psalm is the generation that was not allowed to go into the promised land. And so when you hear about God's wrath and people passing away, it's all about them, and it's not about mankind in general. I don't subscribe to that at all. If you look at the psalm, you will not see any direct reference to anything about the wilderness. Rather, you will hear about you turn man to destruction, and the word is Adam. It's the word that the Old Testament uses for all men. And everything that is said about all men here applies to all men. It's not just that generation of God's people. God is wrathful upon all men. All men need a heart of wisdom. All men are in need of redemption. This psalm is about mankind. But there is a change at verse 13. From verse 1 through 12, Moses has been talking about everyone descended from Adam. But 13 says, "Return, O Lord, how long, and have compassion on your servants." And then in 14 he says, "Oh, satisfy us early with your mercy." And the word is hesed. It is your covenantal mercy. He's used the word servant already. Moses begins to make a distinction among men. All men are in need, but only a certain kind of men can have hope. Men who are in covenant with the Lord, men who are servants of the Lord, they have the right to cry out to the Lord and expect mercy. This is very similar to what we saw when we went through Psalm 14. In Psalm 14, we have that very classic definition of mankind. The fool has said in his heart, "There is no God." They are corrupt. They have done abominable works. There is none who does good. The Lord looks down from heaven upon the children of men to see if there are any who understand, who seek God. They have all turned aside. They have together become corrupt. There is none who does good, not one. But then in verse 4, having said that all the children of Adam are like this, the psalmist begins to talk about, quote, his people and make a distinction. "Have all the workers of iniquity no knowledge who eat up my people as they eat bread and do not call on the Lord?" Well, David, how can you talk about your people? Are you not descended from Adam? Are you not a human being? Well, legally and covenantally, no. In the covenant of God, we have been transferred. We are not just sons of Adam. We have been taken out of his headship, and we have been put under another headship. Legally, we are something else. And Moses begins to talk about the something else. All men are in deathly estate. All men are in need of a heart of wisdom. All men are in need of redemption. But, O Lord, be merciful to your servants. Act for your servants. And everything else for the rest of the psalm begins to be a petition for God's servants. Salvation comes with distinction. Salvation comes with exclusion. God's kingdom is exclusive. There is a wall around it that separates it from the world. The world literally hates the term exclusive. It considers it a vice. If you are exclusive, if you believe in anything short of total inclusion, you are a baddie. But in Scripture, God literally saves by exclusion. You are brought into the number of his servants. You are brought into his covenant. You are separated from the world. There is an us. There is a them. And boy, you want to be us. Because everything Moses is praying for from here to the end, it only applies to us. It only applies to his servants. It only applies to those he is in covenantal faithfulness with. So you can almost make a little notch between verse 12 and 13 because the focus shifts. And I notice that in the New King James Version, they actually leave a little space because the focus has changed. But that does bring us to our next question. If that is the case, what are we to make of verse 15? Make us glad according to the days in which you have afflicted us, the years in which we have seen evil. That seems to have a temporal time signature to it. And those who would define the psalm as having only to do with the generation that perished in the wilderness would say, Moses is saying, you have afflicted us for 40 years. Be gracious and flip that so that the next 40 years you are very gracious to us and we are faithful. And ironically, that is kind of what happens because you have that generation that perishes in the wilderness. You have the generation of Joshua, and we're told that that generation is a very faithful generation. So, you can see where they're seeing here. But Moses has been talking about all mankind. And Moses is now appealing for mercy, and he is not appealing for a mere 40 years of mercy. But it does look like he is appealing comparatively. So what do we make of that? If you look at verse 1 through 12, you see your need, you see the dangerous precipice you were on. Without God's grace, how long will this description of you continue? When will it come to an end if God is not gracious to you? Will it come to an end at your death? Will it come to an end at the end of the world? Will it come to an end when creation itself is remade? Will there be a time where without God's grace, verse 1 through 12 will ever stop affecting you? Will that not be you someday without Christ? The answer is no. Those who are in need of a heart of wisdom, those who are in need of God's grace, those who are under God's wrath, this is an eternal estate unless he does something. And Moses is making a comparison, but it's a comparison of eternities. Oh Lord, you have afflicted upon us an estate whereby, if we are not changed, we will eternally be under your wrath. We will finish our years with a sigh, yes, but that will not be the end. You will eternally be wrathful. You will eternally be angry. This will never, never end, world without end. O Lord, as you have afflicted us, be gracious to us eternally. Take away our eternal death. Take away your eternal anger. Take away the testimony of your wrath forever. Why would Moses pray for simply 40 years? Would you pray for simply 40 years? Moses is praying for something much larger than that. He is praying, O Lord, give us an eternal estate of your mercy. Return and show compassion on your servants. Let your servants be transformed. Let them know your grace. Lord, be merciful to us and establish the work of our hands. You know, I find it interesting that if I look for that which lasts, something that if you go back into the past and you can say, okay, I see where that happened back then and it's continuing till now, about the only thing I can put my finger on is the grace of God in the gospel. God has spoken his word. His word is eternal. Man has tried to destroy his word actively with force, the power of empires. But God has literally had a people from the beginning till now. with every nation, every ideology, every era wanting to destroy it. And that's about the only thing I can find that lasts. Nations don't last. Ideologies don't last. Empires don't last. But God's work in the world does. The good works that God has given to his people to do, to walk in, those works have their effect. But why do they have their effect? It's not because of us. It's because of the only one who can establish the work of our hands. Thanks be to God. The last question, of course, that we must ask of our psalm is the question we always ask, and that is, where do we find Christ? This one's fairly easy. Moses is asking God to do something. We are actually in an estate of cursedness. We are actually truly on the precipice. We are truly under your wrath. So we want you to truly do something. O Lord, turn and have compassion. O Lord, establish. O Lord, act. Moses has, by defining God and defining us, shown us our incredible need. Well, the need cries out. And the answer is Christ. We hear a message like this and we realize who we are and we turn to Christ and say, you are my only hope. You are my only way of salvation. You are what God is doing in the world. You are the answer to Moses' prayer. I need you. And we find Christ. And that is what this is designed to do. Moses is giving us such a dark image so that we will reach for the light, and we find that light to be Jesus of Nazareth. There is no hope other than him. And when Moses prays and says, act, that's what God does.